Welcome back, one and all, to Soft Revolution, the podcast. My name is Torquil Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
And today on the pod, because we thought you might need it, we are talking to Georgia Dow. Georgia Dow is a psychotherapist and analyst, and she's going to come on the pod and talk to us about making it through this. I know that many, many of you out there are struggling with your mental health, with your sense of hopelessness, with anxiety, with depression. And it just felt like the right time to get someone on the pod who might be able to offer some words of comfort, some words of advice, or point you in the right direction towards getting past those feelings. And I, full disclosure, I'm happy Georgia's on the show today because, Ali, I'm struggling. I am really struggling. I don't think I've ever felt this much hopelessness in my life. The news of new variants that are resistant to the vaccine, that are more contagious, potentially more deadly, the gross incompetence and negligence of pretty much every single level of politician and government that we have, the sense that art is now really at an extinction level event has led me into a place where I'm finding it very, very difficult to keep going in the morning. So I'm looking forward to talking to Georgia, and I think she will have some, hopefully, have some words that might move us through this moment. Ali, how are you doing this week?
You know, I'm a little more kind of glass half full than you.
That's the kind of guy you are. That's
the kind of guy, baby.
That's why I love you, baby.
You know, yes, I woke up and I read the same, I think, variant, speaking of variant, of a piece of, you know, Fauci saying that it looks like the South African variant is a little resistant to vaccines, and in even people who have had the virus before, it's a little more elusive to the immune system to begin with. And that really was crap. It was one of those, you know, you just kind of lol, you just LOL, of course, here we are. But you know, you months ago did remind myself and everybody that ultimately we are going to a state of, this is an endemic thing that it's going to be around us. And the more I researched about the South African variant and all these variants, yes, they will be perhaps a little bit elusive to the vaccines, or will be. But ultimately, it just means that this is something that's going to be a part of our lives. Right now, it seems like it's so gross. It's a huge elephant in every room and every corner of your life. But eventually, it's just going to be something like polio, for instance, in which it's just around and we've all are going to have to get vaccinated for it continuously. And that's okay. However, it has made me think in general that the notion of if you take any theater history class, they will tell you about Deus Ex Machina, the godlike machine. Before they constructed ideas of how stories would end, the Greeks would tell a story and then a godlike machine would come to end the story. That's what it would be. Right. It would be a complete and utter shit show, and then the Deus Ex Machina would show up. It's interesting. What a metaphor. I've been thinking about that. It's because we have been looking at these vaccines, ourselves, you and I, governments, as a Deus Ex Machina. The stock market has viewed it the same way too. The first day Pfizer announced 95%. Like, you should have seen it. It was like, nothing happened. We're back, baby.
Well, that's why, that's how it was sold to us. I mean, that was the news, right? Was, don't worry,
I think
folks,
it's also human
it's
nature. Yeah. I think it's human nature. Yeah. But you know what? It's wrong. It's just ultimately wrong. And I kind of really, again, I look at, you know, I just got a text from Alan Detsky, a friend of the show, who's also an investor of Come From Away. He sent me a text and he was like, look, Australia. And he showed me a packed house. They're back and they're wearing masks and stuff. Now I spoke to him and he said, hey, don't worry about it. The fall here, Toronto.
I mean, he's just dreaming. I'm sorry.
Well, he's also,
people have to start getting real about this stuff. Honestly, it's like, there's not going to be any performing art in Canada this year. There just isn't. And
there's going to be some variation of it.
There might be 12 people in a room somewhere.
I think a couple hundred, but it's not going to be, my point is, it's not going to be like that viral video of that concert in New Zealand that everyone was going like crazy and loving it. You know what's interesting about that video? It brought about conversation from all walks of life. It wasn't just in our circle. We viewed it as people lamenting the loss of live music. Right. But I got to tell you, I saw that video on 6buzz TV. You may not know 6buzz TV, but it's like this ridiculous Instagram account that is followed by 2 million people. And it's just like memes and videos in Toronto. Personally, I think it's destructive to the youth of Toronto. But nevertheless, it was on there and you could read the comments from these young people of Toronto saying, yeah, why can't we have that? Why can't we have that? Now, step back. Why does New Zealand have that? Why does Australia have what they have? It's because they didn't go towards mitigation. They went towards elimination.
Yep.
And then I was also thinking about this other thing, about leadership and how leadership is so important and it's so necessary. All of these leaders, Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister in Australia, I don't know his name, doesn't matter, but all of them had the same kind of science advisory tables as every single leader in every country and province and state has.
Yep.
I guarantee you, not everybody in Jacinda Ardern's cabinet was for a total and complete lockdown in pursuit of elimination.
Yep.
I guarantee it. But her leadership, her grand vision went above and beyond and realized that that is what we need to do.
Yep. I think it's important. I think it's important for people to understand that. It's really important for people to understand that. In January, February, Justin Trudeau, Donald Trump, whoever, Boris Johnson, whoever, got this information. They did nothing. They didn't close down flights from China. They weren't honest with people about the spread because A, they are slaves to the corporate capitalist system, and B, they didn't want to hurt their political brand by telling people stuff they didn't want to hear and being called extremists. And so they didn't have the courage as human beings to sacrifice their political gains in order to save us all from this. And here we are. And, you know, you can go around blaming people who have 12 people over their house. That's a stupid thing to do and they shouldn't do it. But we are here in this situation for no other reason than because we elect weak, cowardly, craven, second-rate people to lead our world. And that's on us, ultimately. Why are we okay with this lineup of losers who stand in front of the podium and obfuscate and half-ass and try and compromise with a virus? Why do we elect people with such weak moral character? That's a big question. And I think moving forward, we got to start asking ourselves real, real questions about ourselves as voters being content with the kind of people that are running this country and the world.
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting thing. Something that I also got sparked thinking of. I know all of us in the art world are saying, oh, you know what? They don't care about art. And
they don't care about art.
Running,
they don't
care. I know,
care.
But let me finish. But individuals running restaurants feel the same thing and anything like that. I kind of think everybody now needs to really galvanize towards an idea of like Operation COVID Crush. You know, we can't be like in Operation Wait for Vax. Maybe. We'll see if it comes. I don't know. That's a terrible hashtag. Like Operation COVID Crush is what we should be going for. But on the other end, there is something true here. I have a feeling, and this is an idea I'm stealing from a man who is much smarter than me. His name is Scott Galloway. He has a couple of podcasts. You should listen to him. He's quite funny, but quite brilliant. He said, you know, I guarantee you, because obviously he's from America, and it's even kind of like worse than it is here. But he said, I guarantee you that if the NASDAQ, which is the composite of all the tech stocks, the major tech stocks in the New York Stock Exchange, if the NASDAQ went down 50% instead of it ascending 50%, yep, this would be done.
Yep.
There would be no fucking way that we would be still in this kind of shit show, in this kind of disaster. Quite true. And we see it now. We see, you know, the rates of who's getting infected, where are they from, what's the income level, XYZ, it's still there. But if this was something that was hitting rich people, I guarantee you we would not be in this situation. But it is bringing me an idea, guys. Okay, there are we spoke about this a few weeks ago, but there are individuals who hold two sets of asset classes. Number one, people who own homes. Number two, people who own stocks. Now look, I own stocks. Ali Momo's portfolio is up. It's doing good. But I will tell you something. I should be one-time taxed after this pandemic is over. If you are somebody who has been sitting on your computer, you spoke about this individual. I loved your description of them. You know, the person sitting in their jam jams on their email, making six figures,
yep.
Talking to some people who I love,
yep.
You know who I'm talking to. I think, you know, for the sake of the country, I think it's a patriotic act that I think there should be a one-time tax.
Yeah, and
a one-time fee.
Obviously. And I think it points exactly to what I was saying, that the chances of that happening are precisely zero. There will be not even a discussion of it. It will be eliminated as a possibility right out of the gates.
Because I hope not.
We venerate and worship money and wealth in this society above all other things, above life, above the health of our children, above societal cohesiveness. We value rich people. And we will not make them pay the price for the profits they've made. We will not make them participate in this society. You already see that rich people are starting to resume life much as they lived it before. They're going on vacation. They're gathering together. They're having parties. They're getting vaccinated.
They're richer than ever.
And
it's hilarious.
So this is where my sense of hopelessness comes, is that I feel like there are no lessons to be learned because the lessons are dismissed before they're even taught. And it's a very, very hard thing. So let's talk to Georgia more about all of this later, because I think ultimately none of us know what's going to happen.
Yeah, but she'll hopefully allow us to get through it, whatever yeah. it is.
In other news, this week there was a big, you know, the sort of the only live show you're going to see this year, maybe, which was the the inauguration of Joe Biden as the president of the United States and Kamala Harris as the vice president.
Wait, can we talk about his middle name for a second? Robinette.
Robinette.
Do you know a Robinette?
I do now. I mean,
that's amazing.
No, I don't, but I'd love to. It's a good name for a band, the Robinettes. Someone should start it. I thought it was interesting. I don't think I've ever watched a whole inauguration before because they tend to be unbelievably dull, as I recall. And the last one was so grim that it was hard to watch.
American Carnage. Remember that?
Yeah. Oy. But as it is, I mean, and this is something that we've talked so much about on the pod, it is extraordinary the degree to which politics becomes theater when it's in the public sphere. And it ultimately was a theatrical production. It was choreographed. It had, you know, an opening act. It had J-Lo. It had Lady Gaga.
Had costumes. It had costumes.
Yeah, people dressed up. I was moved by just the simple truth of language being used in a gentle way to describe things like empathy, understanding, patience, care, words that literally have not been used in the public vernacular in the United States in the last 4 years. I mean, that's really what struck me. And I was also struck by the degree to which I felt that it was cathartic for me, and I assume for many others, not because I'm a huge Joe Biden fan or because I think that the neoliberal class are suddenly going to change their stripes and start looking after us all. I'm 48 years old. I'm not that naive. But because it was a way of acknowledging that the last 4 years have been a truly ugly, pointless, hurtful mess. And they are over. He is gone. I mean, this virus isn't gone. But that man is gone, and his influence and his power obviously will continue in many ways. He is, the bitch that bred him will always be back in heat one day, to quote Bertolt Brecht. Great, great, great play, The Irresistible Rise of Arturo Uy. Everybody should read it. It's about Donald Trump. It was written, well, it's about Adolf Hitler, but it's about anybody like these men, and they are always men. Who ascend. And so in that way, I found it very cathartic. And the big revelation, well, not a revelation, but the big sort of aha moment for me was the fact that what was the single biggest thing to come out of that inauguration, apart from the Bernie Sanders meme of him sitting in a chair looking like an old man returning soup.
If I could put that meme in this podcast, I would. But so I just want you to imagine right now Bernie in his mittens listening to us. But yes, I think the reason that's so huge is
because it speaks to the deep soul of every single one of us right now. It's like a physical embodiment of how we all feel. But the big star of the show, the big moment of the whole inauguration was poetry.
Yeah, Amanda
was
Gorman.
Art. Was the young poet Amanda Gorman, 22 years old from Los Angeles, who got up and read beautifully a beautiful poem she had written. But she didn't just read it, she performed it, she acted it. And I was both encouraged and enlivened and overjoyed to find that people responded so strongly to her art, but also left in a state of kind of wonderment at the disconnect, total disconnect between people between the public will to do anything to save art and people's reaction to that poem. Where do we go when we want to express higher purpose? What do we do when we want to feel unity? What do we watch when we want to all feel our common humanity? We go to art. We sing Amazing Grace with Garth Brooks. We listen to a poem read by a 22-year-old African-American woman. And yet, you look at the polling. You look at the surveys that are done about of the public about should art be saved? Should we be spending money on saving art right now? The overwhelming majority believe, no, we shouldn't. There's bigger problems. We can't worry about it. Art is expendable. Art is not necessary. We need to deal with education and healthcare. And of course, we do need to deal with all those things. But I don't know if that can't show people that without art, we have no way of defining what it means to be alive. And if we can't define what it means to be alive, we have no way of being a society. Then I don't know what will show people that. I don't know.
It's interesting.
I don't know.
You're saying some interesting things, brother, because I want to speak about this notion of like education and healthcare. You know, art increases public health, like mental health. It is a cure. And specifically also in respect to education, I kind of think we definitely we need to have more art in our education, not merely for the fact that people get to learn music and poetry and all that stuff that we love and we know it's worthwhile. We have moved into a world in which we think everything can be solved through STEM.
Yep.
Science, technology, engineering, math.
Yep. And this has been going on for 2 decades now.
Yeah. And I get it. You know what? Like STEM has brought some amazing things into this world. I am not someone who's going to say, I'm a geek. I'm a nerd. I'm a geek. They call me the genius bar. You know, they call me and people, if you got a computer problem, you know, at me, I'll fix it for you.
That's what I do.
I'm all for it.
That's why I'm doing this podcast for free computer advice. That's all I do it for.
But we need to move past STEM solutions. We got to think about like STEM plus. I actually think
STEAM. We don't need STEM. We need STEAM. We need to put art in the middle of that science and technology and apply creative and artistic thinking to our policy.
It'll solve a lot of problems. It'll solve a lot of problems. You know, somebody who has read enough poetry and plays, or who has experienced enough theater and has seen paintings and understands the humanities and has read literature, whether it's Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, whatever it is, you know, there something happens to the mind that I really do think prevents the QAnon drop. I really do truly think that. And that, you know, we had Mr. Deibert on talking about how, like, you know, science isn't always going to be our kind of solution to this. And that is really important. So we got to think about that. So it's for like the lifeblood of a nation. But then in general, when I saw that inauguration, I was like, what is a country? It's the borders, the people, the policies, yes. But a country is a figment of our imagination. A country is an idea. And that idea is expressed in the art. A country is a piece of art. And one of the reasons, and I keep on saying this all the time, I call like culture like a magnet, right? What is it about America? You watch that inauguration and you hear those words and you see those images and you literally forget that the number one cause of bankruptcy in America is healthcare. Yeah. You forget that, you know, they are trillions of dollars in debt because their military budget is so high. You forget that only 1963 did Black people get the right to vote. You forget these things.
Yeah.
The idea, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if we eliminate that type of artistry, if we eliminate that high level beyond TikTok, and I'm being serious when I say this, I love TikTok, it's fun, but we got to go past TikTok. If we eliminate that type of artistry, I'm telling you, it kind of ruins a nation. America, all of this stuff, all of this mumbo jumbo that we're like, wow, USA, USA. You know, a lot of it, we've spoken about this before, and Jen Leno either will tell me I'm right or wrong. I hope she's going to tell me I'm right. That's WPA shit right there. That's some stuff from that, you know? So yeah. Just love art, guys, because otherwise you just got TikTok.
Yeah, I mean, art, fascism can't breathe when art is prevalent in society. And when art disappears, fascism breathes very, very easily. And that's what we saw over the last 4 years. And yes, it's nice that Joe Biden likes Seamus Heaney. And it's nice that there was a poet speaking. And it's nice to see artists being a part of that inaugural ceremony. But there are actual human beings who are suffering right now, whose job it is to make art. And until society stops thinking that those people have made some kind of a foolish choice, that they've foregone a real job in order to be artists, until there is some kind of dignity in the work we do from a public perspective, nothing will change for us. And so I am pleading with those of us artists who have the kind of platform that people like Tom Hanks do, or in Canada, any number of people, Drake or whoever, where are you? Where are you for your fellow artists? Where are you? Why aren't you speaking up? Why aren't you lobbying the government for some kind of support? Why aren't you demanding that the government make a plan to return live performances to society? It really feels to me, Ali, now, like that's kind of like a discussion that's over. And the answer is never. That as far as they're concerned,
I don't know about that.
And they don't care. It's not part of their thinking. I have not I've not heard one single solitary journalist mention or speak of or ask any question to any public servant in regard to their plan to bring back culture. Have you?
No, I haven't. I mean, I don't know.
So
I don't want to say
tell
because.
You? That well, tells you that there's zero priority. There's well, no priority. They don't care. They're not interested. They're not going to do anything. So where does that leave us? This is the existential question I'm asking myself. Am I an artist anymore? Can I be an artist anymore if there is no support and no ground to live on and nobody gives a shit whether we exist or not? What am I? I mean, I can make it in my bedroom. I can put up a live stream and have 50 people watch it. But have we in fact reached an actual moment in history where for at least the next decade, being an artist is not a job? It's just something you believe you are.
It's so funny. It kind of what you're thinking is, you know, if a tree falls in a forest and
right.
no one is there.
Yes.
So basically, if art falls in the forest and no one
yeah.
can see it
if,
or no one's there
no
in the
audience,
forest, is it art?
If there's no audience and there's no public support and there's no institutional support and there's no plan and there's no mention of it and no one discusses it, the arts page of the Globe and Mail, the arts page of the CBC. I had a producer from CBC who I'm a friend with the other day get in touch with me. And we were chatting and I said, hey, you know, you guys have really got to cover more the crisis in art. You've got to talk about the mental health crisis in art. You've got to talk about the complete abandonment, the complete lack of plan to return us to any kind of public cultural life. He said to me, I hear you. I try and try and try. The uppers don't want to talk about it.
Mm.
So, I mean, when people say to me that I'm being paranoid and crazy because I say that people don't care and they actually actively at this point are actively have decided that art is expendable. It is collateral damage. We've lost that battle. We're leaving it behind. I want to see evidence to the contrary. And I'm not trying to be confrontational here. I'm actually asking our audience, show me some evidence to the contrary. Show me one single solitary piece of policy enacted to help artists by the Canadian government in the last 3 months. You can't do it.
Well, I think I think they would say CERB.
CERB, which they then tried to recollect from people who had gotten
grant money.
Which
they have subsequently changed,
yes,
thank God.
They were shamed into reneging on this unbelievably cruel policy that they were enacting to recollect CERB from people who declared grant money as income. I mean, what do they think artists are living on in Canada? Do they think that their local poet has sold so many copies of their book that they don't need grant money? I mean, the fact that the CRA is that far out of touch with how artists actually make a living and put food on the table should tell you everything you need to know about our priority place in this society. We are zip, zero, nada, nowhere. So
the way I see it, though, Torque, is like there's only one policy. There's only one policy that I want. Well, two. But the one policy, the most important policy, is crush the virus. And if that means, you know, being a little more difficult with people and not trying to push people towards something, but merely accepting where people are. You know, and we talk about this in terms of the flights and in terms of just transportation and just lock it down in a way that is actually effective. That would be really nice. That's it.
That's it.
You know, that solves everything. This isn't actually, Torque, at the end of the day, this isn't a crisis of politics. This isn't a crisis of policy. This isn't a crisis of the arts. It is, obviously. All these things are, they branch out from that. This is a public health crisis. And the most important thing, the only thing that needs to happen is that this virus needs to die. Is we need to do whatever we can to get rid of the virus.
Yep.
Because when you do that, it's like we spoke about, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs with Chile. When you knock that down first, then you go and self-actualize. But the first thing comes is we got to knock this virus down. But the reason why I'm a little the reason I'm a little more hopeful is that, again, to go back to something like the WPA, nothing is ever finished and complete. The WPA or what we look at the Federal One Project, the arts project, that was towards the end. That was that wasn't the first thing that FDR decided to do when the New Deal. It wasn't like today is the New Deal and has all of these things and c'est fini. That was towards the end. So there's still hope.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you still have hope. It gives me a little bit of hope that you still have hope. But I think, you know, you could not be more correct about having to crush it. We're not going to crush it because in order to crush it, we would have to tax the rich and give that money to people whose jobs and livelihoods were curtailed by the fact that we were trying to crush the virus. And we're not going to do that. We've already made that clear. Billionaires are going to make money. We're not going to tax them. The poor are going to suffer. We're not going to take care of them. That's capitalism. That's the system we live in. Everyone's cool with it. We've elected leaders who protect it. And, you know, until that changes, I don't see us defeating this virus.
I was going to say one way we can defeat the virus is with these vaccinations, obviously. And I want to bring up.
Well, I don't know if that's true anymore. I don't think that they know whether these vaccines are going to withstand the new variants.
No, they know the UK variant that both the Pfizer, the Moderna,
but
and
the South
looks
African
like the
variant, it looks like it doesn't.
Sure. So we're going to figure that out. We're going to knock it down. It's not going to say that it doesn't. They just don't know yet and the information is going to go. But these are, you know, a vaccine, again, is also not a static thing. Mm-hmm. It's not something that, oh, this is the vaccine and that's it.
Well, they can adjust them, right?
They could adjust it. And especially with the messenger RNA stuff, that platform changes very quickly. Like what we've seen is that there's a nimbleness. So that was a good STEM solution. Thank you very much, STEM. That's very great. But speaking of those vaccines, we spoke about how it would be a really great idea if theaters would become centers for vaccination, or concert halls would be centers for vaccination, movie theaters, all these places that you can't go but are perfect for situations like this. Also, if they were to be run logistically by people who know how to get thousands of people in a room 8 times, 10 times a week, These, that's perfect. But Germany took it to the next level because Germany always seems to take it to the next level. They said, you know what? You don't even have to come here to like a theater. We will bring the art to you. So what they've done in many vaccination centers in Germany is that they've put up paintings. They've put up art from local artists so that you walk into this sterile place and there's somebody with a hazmat suit or whatever coming to greet you and PPE all over, there's art around. And I was thinking that would be an amazing thing. It becomes an experience. There's art in the vaccination centers. There's somebody playing violin. No wind instruments, unfortunately, or no singing. But, you know, so like a violin, like a piano. I think that would be an amazing, amazing thing.
Well, of course it would. And think about that extending more broadly into the whole medical community. I mean, imagine if there was a piano in the lobby of a hospital. Imagine if there was a violinist whose job it was to walk around the ICU and play music for people. Imagine.
Well, you heard about that woman. So speaking of Amazing Grace, there was a nurse that they had the day before, one of the most beautiful renditions of Amazing Grace. It was a nurse out of Michigan. And she sang Amazing Grace. And they found her because there was a video of her going viral that she would sing Amazing Grace to the patients in the ICU in Michigan and would bring them hope and life.
Incredible.
You know? So
incredible. But yeah, I imagine. Imagine if we had politicians who were smart enough and brave enough and you know, caring enough to do what they were doing in Germany. It would be a great world. Instead, we have the bunch of dudes we have, and they suck. So I don't know. I the final thing I want to say about Amanda Gorman is that, you know, she is now, of course, at the top of the New York Times bestseller list, and she's on the Today Show, and she's a huge star, and that's wonderful. I couldn't be happier for her. She seems like an amazing person, and I can't wait to see what more incredible work she makes. But can we also recognize there might be other poets? This is the other thing about the way art has operated in society. And this is largely on us. The star system, the needing to specially point out one person or another. You know, John Lennon wrote during a time when there were thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of songwriters just as good as him. And you haven't heard of them. You might have heard of a few of them, but I guarantee you, there are thousands of them you haven't heard of. And our need, our insistence to elevate one above everybody else and
to
not
use... because of business around it.
Yeah. I mean, and Amanda Gorman herself said this. I saw her interviewed and she immediately said that. God bless her. She's like, look, there's so many writers like me. There are so many great poets in America. You know, please go and find them. And that is something that I think we as artists have to start to reckon with, is like every time there's a breakout star like Amanda Gorman, we need to use that to promote the work of other people who have not yet been discovered. You know, young artists are the most exciting, dynamic demographic in the world, in my opinion, and they need our help. They need our platforming. So if you know a young artist that you think is special, get on your social media and platform them, put their work up there, tell people about them, do everything you can to show their talent in the same way that Amanda Gorman is having her talent shown right now, because it is so difficult to rise above the noise. And I'm so happy that one poet did, but you know, we need to live in a world where thousands of poets are at the level of Amanda Gorman. And I guarantee you, if we do, there will be less disease, there will be less suffering, there will be less unhappiness. And even if that's not true, there'll be more understanding of how to get through it. Because without poetry and without art, I don't know how we reckon with this, with all the loss people have faced, with all the sorrow, with all the dead loved ones and all the pain. If we don't have artists, I don't know how we carry on. And that's why I'm proud to be one, even if nobody else gives a shit about us. We should still feel proud. Because
damn right,
we do something so beautiful and so important, and we need to fight for it. We need to fight for ourselves. Listen, let's get to talking to our guest today. Just before we move on, our friends at Crow's Theater, our partners in this podcast, are carrying on Their holiday corner at Dundas and Carlaw in East Toronto. It's been extended to the end of February because they can't legally take it down for reasons that I cannot even imagine. I mean, some of the laws going on right now are seriously comic. But they have this beautiful window display, and all you can really do in Toronto right now is go for walks. So, like, what a perfect thing to do. Go for a walk out in Leslieville. And stop by Crow's and check out their Secret Stories of the Neighborhood display with artwork by Sion Kim, along with a soundscape by David Messia. David is an awesome guy. I've worked with David, incredibly talented person. I bet it's really cool. I wish I was in Toronto so that I could see it. Unfortunately, due to the lockdown in Toronto right now, Gare de l'Est, which is the restaurant that is incorporated into Crow's, is no longer serving snacks and drinks. So you got to bring your own hot chocolate or your own flask of whiskey or your own giant pill, pain-killing pill, whatever floats your boat, but bring it along and go check out the beautiful window displays that remain up until the end of February at Crow's Theater at the corner of Dundas Street East and Carlaw in Toronto, Canada. Okay, let's get to our interview. You ready?
I'm ready.
Let's do it.
Okay, Georgia Dow, thank you so much for being here. You know, when you go on your YouTube channel, it says, what's your tagline? You say, I'm a registered psychotherapist, but I'm not your psychotherapist, or yeah. I might be your psychotherapist.
I'm probably not your psychotherapist. I could be.
Yeah, that's
Full disclosure,
she is not our psychotherapist, but, you know, by the end of it, maybe we wish she was.
Yeah,
you know,
that could change in the next half hour.
Right.
So look, I am going to drop something on you, and this is from a tweet, and I saved this tweet. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to throw this at Georgia. And it's from Rosamund Small, who's a playwright, a Canadian playwright. And she wrote on Twitter, she said, "On Zoom from time to time, I have been catching up with theater friends. They have been using words like forgotten, loser, nothing, pointless, abandoned, darkness, alone, ruined, disappear." And then she writes, "I'm worried about losing lives. Yeah. What can we do?"
Yeah, we're living through a really strange time. And it's interesting because for some people, this is so much like, unfortunately, we don't really know what other people are living through. And if you're alone, if you feel invisible, if you don't have a strong circle of internet friends, this can become... And even if you do, it's just monumentally hard because the things that we might have used before to prop ourselves up are taken from us. And we're kind of stuck in this feeling of powerlessness, perhaps hopelessness, being alone. And that's really tough. We're not made to be solo creatures. We are made to be around other people. And it's very rare, even if you're someone that's more often alone, more introverted and like your alone time, there's a very small percentage that are true hermits to that, like really enjoy being completely solo and isolated from the world. And that feeling of forced isolation, which many of us are under, can be devastating for our feelings of self and identity and worth and being able to connect. And so I always ask people to kind of reach out to those that they know. And sometimes people don't want to say, "I'm not feeling okay." It's hard. It's hard to reach out. It takes a lot of strength to be able to say, "I'm not coping well," or "I miss being with people." And so the first thing is to kind of check in with those that you know. You don't have to be their therapist, but just to let them know, you know what? I got you. You're not alone. I'm here. I just wanted to hear your voice. And for some people, that's enough to get them through the day. And if you're going through that situation, it really is, how do we get the feelings of isolation and depression and anxiety that can come from living through a pandemic, which has not happened in 100 years. This is something that none of us foresaw. But it's a very specific set of skills. We need to, you know, get some sunlight. We need to go outside. We need to be able to do things. This is not that easy because you have to create this, right? You have to create dopamine and feelings of what is my identity. And that might be completely changed, right? If you are, say, you know, you worked in theater, you worked in the arts, and it was like all of these, many of our lives have been shut down and completely changed. And we don't know what's the world going to be like that we get back to, but if we stick together and we speak with each other, we can do this.
I think identity is such a big part of it. For me, you know, talking to for me specifically, we started the podcast today with me admitting to Allie that I'm really struggling right now. It's, you know, as I'm sure everyone is experiencing out there, except for that rare bird that seems to be having a fine time. I occasionally talk to people who are like, I love it. I kind of feel homicidal when they tell me that. But you know, going through those cycles of like, I'm okay, I've got hope, I'm not okay, I have no hope. The one thing that has been consistent for me is trying to reckon with a loss of my sense of identity, which is something that I have never really had to face before in my life. I've always been an artist. Since I was a kid, I've been an artist. And I've always come from a very strong support group, a community of people. I've been around theater people and rock and roll people. And so I didn't, you know, you're until your identity is gone, you don't know you have it. Does that make sense? Right. It's almost like you wear it like an invisible coat on you, and then that invisible coat is taken and you're like, where's my coat? Is there something that you can say about how to regain a sense of identity even when the trappings that give you that identity are no longer around?
And I think that that's wonderfully said about the coat that you don't know is gone until you've lost it. It's just like being healthy. If you lose, you don't know how wonderful it feels to be healthy until you don't feel well.
Right.
We often don't appreciate, we take granted the things that we have that are surrounding us that keep us up until they're missing, and we feel that shaking. And so, like, how do you kind of regain that sense of self and that centeredness is, again, it's multi-layered, but I'll give you some tips and tricks to that. But it's actually quite in depth, because it is, who am I and who am I to myself? Which, if you are getting, so self-esteem and self-identity, there's two ways to get it. There's extrinsic forces, outside forces, accolades from others, interactions with things, your degree, your latest endeavor that you've done, you know, creating something. They're all actually kind of extrinsic, outside of you. Intrinsic self-identity and self-esteem come from, how do I reflect on myself? How do I feel when I do this? What are the things that make me feel like I have self-worth, and what is my inner dialogue about that? And so, even though a lot of the extrinsic things are probably taken from us during this time, and for many people, a lot of them are, or perhaps even almost all of them are, we can work on the self piece, which is actually much more stable, right? A lot of Olympians or, movie stars, you know, they're only as good as the last movie, and they're only as good as their last performance. And then if they stop going to the Olympics, because they go through a crash, because that was their identity, it's been taken from them. And so we always talk about going back into yourself and looking at who you are as a person in a way that is really genuine and honest, because we're not this shell. We're not like what we produce. We are not what we have done. We're not what other people think of us. But we are who we think, we advertise who we are to ourselves. And so I always say to people, you know, one is, work on that negative voice. If you've been saying a lot of mean things, what's happening inside of your head? Which, when we've taken away all of the shiny glitter from our lives, we can really take a look at what is left over. And we are what is left over. And so we can really work on that. And I think that in the times when we struggle the most, they're painful and difficult, but we can also use that to make ourselves stronger and better and more resilient to after. And I think that in the best possible way, we can use this time to really work on, what is our relationship with us? What are we doing with ourselves? And often we're not the best bedfellows to us. We're not the kindest to ourselves. So I have people journal. Like, I know people are like, oh God, Georgia, really journaling. but even when I spin, and if I can't, and I'm very good with what we call cognitive restructuring the way that you think to yourself. It's a fancy way of just saying changing the way that you think. If I spin and I can't do it through just thinking about it, because the limbic system, the primal part of our brain, takes over and they're not the nicest, I journal it out, and I get it onto paper so I can look at it, because that forces my thinking part of the brain to interact with the primal part of my brain and look at what is there. And if I've been mean or cruel or negative or worrisome or hopeless, that part of the brain can talk to it, and we can have a kinder, gentler conversation than we would if we just, because that part of the brain will just run off into like dark places on its own. We need the parent part of the brain to kind of bring it back. And so journaling is one. Two, you know, you have to do things for yourself through the day that make you feel good, that build you back up. Creating things is really good. Making things that you didn't make before, trying something new, learning a new skill, that creates a lot of dopamine. But if you are in a very dark place, the amount of dopamine, the things that you do in your brain, you want to keep on doing. We like doing the things that we're good at. But if we've gone through a period of depression, we're not producing a lot of dopamine. That's the motivating neurotransmitter that makes us feel happy and sparkly and alive. We go through a mild form of hibernation. And so we're not producing a lot of dopamine. So the thing is that when you start these activities that might have brought you a lot of joy, probably won't. And that's hard. So a lot of people just give it up because they're like, I just don't enjoy this anymore. But it's not. It's just when the brain starts to reactivate, it's not reactivating at the same level as it is before, because this part of your brain has kind of gone into like stasis for a little while. So to kick it back into gear is hard.
Dopamine's an interesting thing, because I think especially for artists and performing artists in particular, I mean, I spent 20 years experiencing at least, 30 to 50 times a year, the sound of 1,000 people cheering for me.
Right. Wow.
And any actor who works in repertory theater or works regularly, Ali, 8 times a week up until last January,
people would like was getting jump a standing to their feet, ovation, yeah. Right? Come from away, yeah.
So
and crazy. What, people were getting lit. It was the best.
So it's a drug that has been taken away from you. And
there's
and so,
not much like that, right?
No.
Like to have that kind of adoration and feedback.
No,
there's not many things that can do the same amount that 1,000 people.
Is it good to remember that, Georgia? Is it good to like reminisce about that? And even though it's been kind of it's hibernating, the industry is hibernating.
Yes,
is it healthy for me to remember the good?
To remember the good, unless it causes you a lot of pain, it really depends on your own personal journey to it. A lot of people, if it causes you, like, remember that you are constantly feeding your brain information and whatever you, we spend a lot of time of saying, be careful what you eat, and you are what you eat. You are what your brain consumes, what you think also. And so if it causes you just sadness and remorse and desolation of the loss of that, because we do also mourn a loss of, some people just leave a career and they mourn the loss because they're not going back. That we need to have something else to kind of replace that as well. So it depends. If you can enjoy it and enjoy that moment and relive that to create some dopamine, awesome. If it just causes you sadness and hardship, then I would say maybe that's not the thing you should be feeding on.
Yeah, I think this is the trap that a lot of, certainly I find myself in often these days is, the past is painful, the future is uncertain.
Right.
So the now.
Regret lives in the past and anxiety lives in the future, and we live in right now. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So now it feels like the dopamine thing is interesting to me because, as you said, doing the stuff that creates that dopamine and gets you to that place, you may find it's not working. And so then you go into the future or the past because the now isn't working for you. Can you talk a little bit about breath, about the place for breath in all of this?
So breath meaning breathing?
Yeah.
Or breath meaning a respite?
Well, I guess breath meaning breathing. I think that that's something that a lot of artists have been trained in is breathing and using breath to achieve relaxation or to achieve open-mindedness especially in performing arts, there's a lot of focus on breathing. Mm-hmm. Is there a scientific effect to correct breathing, to treating yourself to 5 minutes of really thinking about your breathing?
Yeah, there is. There is. And I'll go through why, because a lot of people are like, well, I'm breathing all the time, so what does it matter?
Right?
I'm always breathing. I'm
shallow,
always breathing.
Panicked breaths don't count.
No. Actually, they can bring on a panic attack.
Yeah, hyperventilation is not what we're talking about.
No. Not good. Don't do more of that. Unless you're readying yourself for a fight. fighters before they go into the ring want that adrenaline rush. And so they're hyping themselves up, smacking themselves in the face, jumping up and down. They want that adrenaline shot. But for most of us, we're not getting prepared to run from a tiger or get into a fight. And so we're just getting adrenaline that just makes us feel horrible. But it has its purpose. It has its purpose. But doing so why does breathing work? It does work. And if you're really good at it, it's a skill. It's not a trick. It's kind of a skill. So a skill means you get better with time. The nice part, if you are a musician or if you work in theater, you work on your breathing because you don't want to get out of breath, or singers as well. Scuba divers, fighters, you know, people that do sports, it's really important how you breathe because you can burn yourself out. You might not have the amount of energy that you need. So breathing does two things. So one is that when we're feeling anxious, our body does kind of a body scan. What is happening? Am I okay? And then it cognitively, so that's the limbic part, the primal part of our brain, kind of does a physical scan of our body. Am I all right? And then the cognitive part thinks and goes, what's my surroundings like? So it's tracking our heart rate and our breathing rate. So one thing is that if we're doing slow, deep breathing, so that is you take a deep breath in, hold it for a moment, and then you breathe out all the air. And then do that, rinse and repeat. I don't count. People say you do 6 seconds in, 8 seconds out. It doesn't actually matter. As long as you breathe out more than you breathe in, so we're getting rid of all of the carbon dioxide, and that we let our body relax. Because when we're getting anxious, we are preparing ourselves for battle and we're tensing up. But our body reads that as danger. So it increases our anxiety cup. If we're doing slow, deep breathing, our cognitive system and our limbic system says, you know what? You mustn't be running from a tiger because your carbon dioxide levels are not increasing. And two, you're breathing like you would be sleeping. So I guess things must be okay. I'll hold off on some adrenaline. Mm-hmm. And we might also, when you get good at this, you can kick in natural endorphins. I get a little bit, and this sounds horrible, but I'll just say it. I get a little bit of a high when I do it. Like I get a little tingly, happy, sleepy, daisy kind of nice feeling from it. When you get good enough and this becomes muscle memory, and if you're already trained in breathing, this happens very effortlessly once you're aware, you can kick in natural endorphins, which make us feel calm and safe and relaxed, and are the opposite of that cortisol and epinephrine, adrenaline, that we get in our system when we feel anxious. And you can reach that zen-like state. And so by doing this breathing, and if you can do it for, we like to say like 8 times a day, and I don't count them. I don't count the breath. I just make sure that I take a deep breath in, I pause, let my body slow down. I just think slower. And then I breathe out all the air and I think melt. If we do that through the day, and one is after I did that one breath, you can probably tell that I get excited when I podcast. I get excited all the time. But like my breath, my voice is even deeper than it was before. And I can always watch when I do like whatever video on anxiety, I do the breathing technique. I'm like, oh, look at that. My voice is like a total octave or two lower than it was before because I'm calmer. And so if you do that every day in a year, so they did this test, which is really cool. They had people with a cut. Well, I'll do the other one. They had people that they took a look at their brain scans and they tested them and they were all 40. And they had one group that they did 6 minutes of meditation. So breathing techniques, it doesn't have to be any type of, any meditation is fine, but it's just breathing techniques for a period of time that in the day equals up to 5 minutes about. So if you're doing whatever, 10 breaths, 8 times a day, you're probably hitting that. And they tested them in a year. The people that did not do this 5 minutes, I think it might have been 6 minutes of meditation a day, their brains were like 41-year-olds. Fine. The brains of the people that had done this every day, and nothing else was different statistically in the two groups, their brains were like brains of people 10 years younger.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah. Now, if you could sell this in a pill, everyone would be doing this.
Of course.
You know, but it is a little bit of time. It's boring. It's hard to remember, but it works. But you need to do it often. Like I want you to hit about like 250 to 1,000 times before you really get the full effect of this. So like one is you have to pay it forward. It's similar to exercise, which is the other thing that I'll be asking people to do. Do your exercise. If you're not exercising, you're not getting the full benefit. And our bodies need it, especially now. We need this. So breathing will actually help your body heal. It's the only other time that we go besides sleep, which we do most of our repair work. But we do it also if we hit a nice set of meditation and our bodies are really calm. We only repair our body when stress levels are low, because in the middle of battle is not the time to repair all the barricades. We do that at the end. We just fight during the time of battle. But we do all that fixing of building back up afterwards, and our bodies are the same.
That's why I wanted you to talk about it, because I think it's such a simple way out of a moment that I forget all the time. And that I think is something that is available. It's like, it's what we do to stay alive, but it's also what we can do to live in with some more value. I want to ask one more thing. And sorry, Ali, I know you've got some questions. And I appreciate your time so much. And I've got this list of questions. So I wanted you to talk a bit about grief.
Right.
Because I definitely feel that I am grieving.
Yeah.
You know, I've lost people I loved, and mm-hmm. I can identify that my body and my mind is going through some of the same things that it went through when I grieved those people I lost.
Yeah.
Is there, first of all, are the stages of grief a real thing, or is it just a kind of morass that you come out of when you're finally tired of feeling sad? And secondly, is there a way to turn that grief into creativity? Because one of the big, big things that I think is happening amongst my peer group and my friends, and I've seen people writing and tweeting about as well, is that people are having such a hard time being creative. So having mm-hmm. lost their job, having lost their identity, they go in search of it by doing, as you suggested, work, you know, make art, do something creative. And yet they find themselves blocked in this grief. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there a way of using creativity to get through that grief?
So let's go through the stages of grief. There are man-made stages that someone found. Some people do go through them and do go through them in the stages that are there. And some people don't. It's fine if you skip stages. Everyone grieves differently. It's a very,
very personal.
We can often be judgy about someone else that grieves through humor or grieves through doing things. We can often be judgmental, which is a horrible thing for the person that's going through that, because grief in all of its forms is difficult. And whichever way you grieve, you should be given permission to grieve and support to be able to do that. So you want to be acknowledging and not judgmental to yourself in the manner in which you go through the process. We do need to actually deal with it. I think that sometimes we avoid it and never want to deal with it because it's unpleasant. And that often has an effect of we stuck it in the, you know, that's the box that we stick inside of the closet. We're not going there, but it'll probably come back up at some point in time. So I do think that we need to deal with the grief and not just avoid that. But the way that you deal with it may be very different from each person. I think that being kind and loving to yourself is good. And I think that there is a time when you can allow yourself a space of time to kind of just shut down and regroup. But the pieces is that you want to regroup. You need to find the pieces to help you also rebuild. And so I think that we need both of those. The ability to give yourself the space to be allowed to grieve, allow yourself some space to shut down, tell your people there's some people that grieve and want to be around people. There's some people that grieve and want to be in the cave alone. And that's fine, whichever way it is. And then you do need, though, at a certain stage to be like, okay, I'm ready now. I need to pick up the pieces and rebuild. And how to do that depends on each person. And that's why, you know, when I give suggestions, usually if I'm doing it with therapy, it's to a certain person. I know their personality type and what their way might be. We kind of go through it together. But one person's way may not be your way, and that's okay as well. The way to kind of get to that, to be able to deal with it, and I'll go through the basic stages to it, is that you want to acknowledge that grief, that loss, that it is true. And even if, you know, so many people say, I don't have a right to my pain because other people have it worse. We do that a lot. I have a lot of people that are like, I feel bad for feeling bad that I lost my, say, job when someone else lost three family members. Or, you know, someone like, and so we kind of
get into this comparison competition of grief.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of guilt, I think, for people. I'm speaking for myself as well, where I'm like, why are you indulging yourself in this? There's, you know, people have lost loved ones, people have, you know, people are suffering.
Yes. But everyone has a right to their own grief. No one should be in pain. And there's, if we did that comparison thing, then no one has a right to their grief, because the person that lost two people, someone else lost six. Someone that's missing one arm, there's someone else that's missing two arms. Someone that's missing two arms and a leg, there's someone else that's missing two arms and a leg and cannot speak. Like, we could go through this and then no one has a right to their grief, and we're all just in pain. Pain is unpleasant, and I don't think that we should disallow that to our own journey. I don't think that we should get stuck in it and stay there, but I think that we all need to validate and hear our own pain, and that it is all valid, and we all should work on feeling better, and we all have a right to that. And so, like on the internet, I often see the, you know, I should be so happy, but you know what? This is a hard time for everyone. I have people that are billionaires and they're having a rough time. And, you know, I have people that are just working hand to mouth, but having a great time.
Right.
It really doesn't matter. It's all of our own personal reflection, and we all have a right to that, and it's all valid. And so, you know, the next time that you see someone else that's in pain, pain is just pain. And some amount of thought and care goes a long way. And I think that sometimes, because of the internet and the anonymity, and we're so easy to just give that one shot, funny, fast answer to other people, that we often lose a little bit of the empathy and humanity of, we're kind of all in this boat and it's difficult for many people. And so acknowledging and validating is the first step that you should do through your own grief. And again, I would say you should write it down. You don't have to, but
Can you talk about what the effect of writing it down is from a neurological perspective?
Why do I push this so strongly?
Yeah.
So it's very interesting. When we're in a limbic state, so when we're feeling really anxious, really upset, really sad, our brain shuts down, and you can feel it. You can feel it. So what happens is that the limbic system is the middle part of the brain, kind of the brainstem, the cerebellum, and then we have all the middle part of the brain. It's flat. It's not very intelligent, but it's very strong. And that's where our breathing gets dealt with. That's where some of our emotions are. That's where our anxiety system resides. And when we get into a very, deep state, strong state, it actually cuts off the cognitive system. It shuts down our working memory. And that's why when we're really depressed, really anxious, really angry, really sad, our brains are not thinking very well, because we've actually chemically shut down the cognitive system. And so it's not helping us. And it used to be very beneficial when we're in tribal places. You don't want to overthink it, right? Go left, go right. It's going to eat, the tiger going to eat Bob. Too many thoughts, and then that's it. We're dead. So that doesn't work out. So that was a good system when we live in a very dangerous place. By writing out our problems, writing is a cognitive system. We have to use our thinking part of the brain to write.
Uh-huh.
One. So that starts feeding, that wakes up the thinking part of our brain that we need to solve these problems. Right. And we need to validate ourselves. So that's one. Two, we usually, most people, and that's why I like handwriting. And I'll tell you why I like handwriting over a computer. Computer's fine. Do it. If that's the only way you can do it, right? But writing, you write slower than you can think. So it slows down the thoughts. And writing is also cognitive. So then we're reading it, and we're reading it in our own hand, and it's slower. And almost always when we write it down, it's not as bad as we had thought it. Because remember, the limbic system is about the intelligence level of a three-year-old. Like, it's not that intelligent. It's very smooth. It's not the bumpy part of our brain that we're really proud of. We should be proud of that too. It's just there to keep us safe and listen to us. But it's not very intelligent. And so this helps us see what it is. And usually we can think, you know, it's not that extreme. And then the last part is that it's there. It's on hard copy. We have given it a space to exist that is outside of ourselves.
Right.
And it's not ephemeral like a computer where we just turn it off. It has a place that is there that we can look back on in our handwriting. And the things that we see, we believe. There's most of our brain, when we deal with the senses, the vision, our sense of vision takes up a lot of our brain. And so we believe the things that we see. And so writing it down gives a lot of power to it. It can be painful also, but it's very healing. And in comparison to speaking with a licensed therapist, journaling is the next best thing to be able to deal with painful situations.
there's something, there's like a sense memory to writing it down on paper,
yeah.
You know, and especially when you go back, you remember, mm-hmm. You see just how the ink moved and when your hand got tired. And then yes. as the paper ages, this is something that you never get. I mean, if you write in Times New Roman .12, it'll always be Times New Roman .12. So
yes.
that's a very, very, so it's this living thing as you live. It's really fascinating.
Yes.
I read somewhere, aka Deepak Chopra, but yeah, he yeah. told me that the five reasons humans suffer is not knowing one's true self, fear of change, believing in permanence in an impermanent world, fear of death, and then clinging to the ego. This pandemic, it's like all five of those when you mm-hmm. think about it. Huge change, impermanence, clinging to the ego, who am I, what's going on, and then obviously death and all of that stuff. But I want to particularly zero in on change, because yeah. so many of us in the arts, whether you were a performing artist, whether you were a visual artist, we are considering the great pivot. We are asking ourselves, do I do something else now with my entire life?
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could just give those people, not the ones who are resisting it, but the ones who are actually down that path. Mm-hmm. I know you spoke about self-image before, and I think this is kind of where the root of this question is. But is there anything you could say to those people who are now back in school, for instance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Change is linked with danger and fear of failure and fear of success and also identity, but we weren't made, it's hard for us to change. It's a big risk often, even if it isn't actually a risk, we see it as a big risk. Because remember, we used to live, our brains have not evolved much in 150,000 years. So we're talking about caveman brains in a modern society. And so we're made to be change adverse. Change came with risk. We moved to a different area. We don't know the type of predators. We don't know the food that is there. We don't know if there's going to be a proper water source. We don't know what the land is going to be like. Even changing tribes was going to be difficult, right? And so there's some people that are very pro change, but most of us are change adverse. And it comes with all of these natural fears that might come up. Not because there's actual danger in this case. If you take a course, it's not going to be that an invading tribe is going to be coming in because of that. But remember, our brain is naturally set to want to keep things the same. Even if you're in a horrible situation, that can be an insurmountable fear to be able to make that jump to do something new.
Right.
Because of
it's
a
like
preset.
Someone in an abused relationship. Yeah.
Oh,
like
yeah.
An abusive
it's the
relationship,
devil
yeah.
we know, right? And so at least we know these variables, and your brain will say, and you've stayed alive, right? And it's kept you alive. So why risk it? Why do that? We want to remind ourselves, and again, I would say journal it, but anyways, because when you look through it, it's like, oh, it's not actually that bad. Because remember, the limbic system will go to the worst case scenario, right? Like it'll go to, you know, desolation and all kinds of places, even if that isn't in the cards. But you want to remember that this is actually, in these many of these cases, you know, change is actually much more adaptive to us and the benefits that will come with change, right? You want it to be the journey, not the end result, that learning something new will be exciting and that it's not success, your goal, but the journey that is your goal. And I think that we also are very success, like the end result driven instead of the process driven. And so what you want to do if you are thinking about making a change is write it out, go through the pros and cons to that. And I do two exercises that I like quite a lot that help me when I decide to do something. One is, what will I regret less? I try to live my life with the least amount of regret as possible. And so I look back on my life and I say, you know, if I do this, what would I regret more, that I didn't try it or if I tried it and failed? And I definitely am on the side of, I don't want to live with regret. Failure, I've done stuff and failed. And I'm not going to say it felt pleasant. I did not like it at all. It was a very unpleasant experience. But at least I'm like, you know what? I've knocked that off my list. That's not meant for me. And that's okay. Not great, but it's okay. And the second one is, you want to work your way backwards. Where do you want to be in whatever, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years? But let's keep it to short, 2 years. Where would you want to be? Because either way, we age and that time will pass. And so if you're thinking, I would be really happy in whatever, 4 years, actually doing accounting, because that's another of my passions. Well, then work your way backwards. The easiest way to get through a maze is start by the end. So what are the steps to get me to that stage? And if you use those two tricks in our mind, the, you know, what would I regret more? Not trying this or trying it and failing, or, you know, whatever are your two variables. So you don't live with regret. And two, find out where you want to be and then go backwards in those steps to be able to get there. And yes, the process may not be that easy, but let's just say it. If we're here and this is our one shot, play and play to win. Because in the end, like, this is what is our journey to ourselves is, I would want to try out everything, and whatever sticks to the wall sticks, and whatever doesn't, I clean up and I deal with. But play to win and enjoy that process. And we don't win all the time, but at least you won't live with regret.
Amazing advice. Amazing advice. Georgia, thank you so, so much for this.
It's, hey, how can people find you? Because I think after this, people are going to really want to, all our listeners, like, how can people find Georgia Dow?
Okay, so I have a YouTube channel. It's really new. It's Georgia Dow, so you can find that. There's one called Apple Talk. You can email me. It's Georgia@WestmountTwoTeesTherapy.com, WestmountTherapy.com. And I'm on Twitter. It's Georgia_Dow.
You've been so generous and I think so practical as well. And that's what I'm really grateful for, is that I know that there are people who are going to feel better if they take some of the advice that you offered today, including myself. I'm going to go journal right now.
Good.
Because you got to get it out of you. It's so true.
Exactly.
It feels sometimes despair gets locked inside you, and that it just goes in this vortex of feeding itself. And,
yes.
And, you know, our profession is to express ourselves. And I think that artists often don't take enough time to use their gifts to look after themselves. They're always thinking about how they can use their gifts to make a living or to express something that other people will be affected by. But
yeah.
I think all of those talents and all of those gifts that artists contain within themselves are both right now, you know, because of the situation art is in, it's very difficult, but it also means that talent group, that set of skills is uniquely lends itself to getting out of it.
Yes.
Mentally for yourself. You know, we have the imaginative and interpretive power to use some of these incredible pieces some of the exercises that you were talking about to move ourselves out of that space. So thanks. I really appreciate it. It's
You're
really
welcome.
Nice of you to share that with us. Georgia Dow on Soft Revolution. Man, did I need that. Thank you so much, Georgia.
Yeah, I hope we all got what we needed. I know definitely. Also, what was great, as you mentioned, she had tangible things to do for us to get through. And so appreciative of that.
And please, you know, if you're out there and like me struggling, please take her advice. Do some journaling. Work on your breathing for 5 minutes a day. It doesn't feel good at first. But, you know, that many smart people can't be wrong. And I know, because it's worked for me in the past, that kind of work of just taking care of your body, exercising, breathing, writing your thoughts out on a piece of paper, there is no shortcut to feeling better. There's just these simple tools that recalibrate your brain and put your soul back into a direction that you can cope with. So thank you so much, Georgia, for joining us and for giving us that free advice and for being so clear and lucid and generous with it. Really, really appreciate it. You know, just before we were taping this section, Allie, we were talking about your pal, who is one of the producers of Come From Away, talking about how the
Alan
theater
Getsky.
Was going to be back, and how in, you know, rock shows, people standing together in rock clubs like that, like in that video from New Zealand, aren't going to be for a while. And I said, well, it could be 3 months from now. We just don't have the public will to get there. We don't have the political courage to get there. We could all be hugging each other in July with no vaccine. But for some reason, we've decided that the people who run Walmart and the corporate CEOs who need to make their money off of our constant desire to consume are more important than being together or having a society that works or any of the other things that the people of New Zealand are enjoying right now, because they showed a little discipline and had some leadership that didn't care about their poll numbers. So, you know, all that to say, if you don't like the way things are, get in touch with your MP or your member, your member of parliament or your congressman or whoever, wherever you are, let them know. And don't stop letting them know until they start to enact policy that is actually going to get us out of this thing, instead of just pay lip service to it and then follow their corporate masters down the road of doom.
That is true, because if you think about it, you know, the only kind of protestation and lament that I bet you a politician hears is from that business or from that person or from that anti-masker or from the anti-vaxxer who's like, open up, blah, blah, yep. blah. But if you're somebody who believes that Operation COVID Crush is what is right, I bet you they're not hearing that.
Nope.
I really, truly bet you they're not hearing that, because you're most likely in your house being quite responsible and not
talking
to anyone.
They're thinking there's no public appetite for that approach, and I think they're profoundly wrong. I think they're profoundly wrong. Anyway, that is Soft Revolution for another week. We hope that it helped. Georgia Dow's wise words helped you. We hope you're doing okay. And I do want to go back, just before we leave, to that incredible image of that young woman standing on that huge stage in front of the audience of the world and speaking her truth and using rhyme and rhythm and intonation and using her hands and using her face to change things, to tell a story, to speak to people's souls, to give people some hope, to give people some sense of direction. Every single one of you out there who is an artist is capable of that. Even if everything's been taken from you, you're still capable of that. You still have that inside you, and don't ever forget that.
Beautiful. What's your art pick, my friend?
My art pick is going to be that, and I think we should play some of Amanda Gorman's poem as we go out. I know it's been much played, but as a reminder that we're all capable of doing what she did, of using our soul, using our voice, and using our talent to speak our truth and try and change the world a little bit. So that's my art pick, is Amanda Gorman.
I love it. I love it. My pick is actually an online museum. Well, it's a real museum. I think it's pronounced Maurice Schuss Art Gallery, but they've done something really crazy. It's actually where Johann Vermeer's Girl with a Pearl Earring sits. Ah. But they've taken this painting and they have done, you know, you've heard of megapixels. You may have heard of gigapixels. This is petapixel. 10 petapixels. They have scanned this.
Wow.
You can zoom into this painting as if you're diving
forever
in it. Like, it, yeah, it's like an Almodovar film. I don't know if you've seen the movie Talk to Her, where there's this part in Talk to Her where the man goes inside a woman. Anyways.
That's
weird.
For the night show.
That's for the night show. Anyways, Talk to Her, one of the best movies ever, but it is amazing. And you could actually, not just that, but you could walk through their museum and you could zoom in on all the paintings and get so close to everything. It's really, really, really cool. I'm going to put the link up if you just want to go kind of virtually visit a museum. Yes, you know what? Can you see if there's a little pretty something something also looking at that painting, and you could go up beside that woman and say something nice? No, you can't do that. One day that's coming back. I hope. In the meantime, you know, you could view this digitally, and it's incredible.
Such a cool idea. And it speaks to something that actually someone said to me a few days ago, which is that we are all miniaturists now, that every piece of life's pleasures is in the miniature things. We can only focus on the small because the large is so insurmountable and so incalculable and so unknowable. And, I guess that's really what we've got to do, is double down on the small things and get into being miniaturists and keep focusing on those tiny, beautiful things that make life worth living. That's Soft Revolution for this week. We'll be back next week. We love you all so much. Take care of yourself. Wear a mask. Write to your political leaders and say, this shit ain't good enough. We need to crush this COVID.
Yeah.
I'm Torquil Campbell. Thanks for joining us. Love you, Allie.
Love you, bro.
Mr. President, Dr. Biden, Madam Vice President, Mr. Emhoff, Americans, and the world. When day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade? The loss, we carry a sea we must wade. We've braved the belly of the beast. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace. In the norms and notions of what just is, isn't always just is. And yet the dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. We, the successors of a country and a time where a skinny black girl descended from slaves and raised by a single mother can dream of becoming president, only to find herself reciting for one. And yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We are striving to forge our union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters, and conditions of man. And so we lift our gazes not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know to put our future first, we must first put our differences aside. We lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms to one another. We seek harm to none and harmony for all. Let the globe, if nothing else, say this is true. That even as we grieved, we grew. That even as we hurt, we hoped. That even as we tired, we tried. That we'll forever be tied together, victorious. Not because we will never again know defeat, but because we will never again sow division. Scripture tells us to envision that everyone shall sit under their own vine and fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. If we're to live up to our own time, then victory won't lie in the blade, but in all the bridges we've made. That is the promised glade, the hill we climb, if only we dare it. Because being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it. We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it. Would destroy our country if it meant delaying democracy. And this effort very nearly succeeded. But while democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated. In this truth, in this faith we trust, for while we have our eyes on the future, history has its eyes on us. This is the era of just redemption. We feared it at its inception. We did not feel prepared to be the heirs of such a terrifying hour, but within it we found the power to author a new chapter, to offer hope and laughter to ourselves. So while once we asked, how could we possibly prevail over catastrophe? Now we assert, how could catastrophe possibly prevail over us? We will not march back to what was, but move to what shall be, a country that is bruised but whole, benevolent but bold, fierce and free. We will not be turned around or interrupted by intimidation, because we know our inaction and inertia will be the inheritance of the next generation. Our blunders become their burdens. But one thing is certain. If we merge mercy with might and might with right, then love becomes our legacy and change our children's birthright. So let us leave behind a country better than the one we were left. With every breath from my bronze-pounded chest, we will raise this wounded world into a wondrous one. We will rise from the gold-limbed hills of the West. We will rise from the wind-swept Northeast where our forefathers first realized revolution. We will rise from the lake-rimmed cities of the Midwestern states. We will rise from the sun-baked South. We will rebuild, reconcile, and recover in every known nook of our nation, in every corner called our country. Our people, diverse and beautiful, will emerge battered and beautiful. When day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as we free it. For there is always light, if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it.